Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studios in Beijing. I'm your host, Kaiser Guo. Joining me today are regulars Jeremy Goldcorn, the man behind the endlessly informative Danwei.org. Great to see you, Jeremy. How are you?
Thank you very much, Kaiser, and thanks for the new adjectival clause.
I wasn't really sure what was going to come after endlessly there.
Endlessly diverting, informative.
Sure. Yeah.
And then the ineffable Gadi Epstein, Beijing bureau chief of Forbes, back after missing a couple of podcasts. We missed you there, Gadi.
Thank you, Kaiser. Missed you guys, too.
And we're very happy to have you back. And we are also absolutely delighted to be joined by Li Xin, who does not yet deserve an adjective because this is her first time on the show. She is English editor for Caixin magazine. Welcome to Cynical, Li Xin.
Good to be here. Thanks. Kaiser. I will try my best to earn my adjective.
I'm sure you will. Li Xin, you are in charge of English there, right, at Caixin, the English site and the annual English magazine, is that right? And the site, if you're not familiar with it, is english.caing.com.
Which makes perfect sense.
What? Caing, which I think means wiping, right? Caing piu or something. Anyway, we are happy to announce...
No, it's tying.
Making money.
Making money.
Tying. Yeah.
One way or another.
It's just literally lost an eye.
Or using money to wipe yourself.
Right. Which
you have so
if
much
you have of enough it. Of it, yeah. You're able to do. Right. Anyway, we are happy to announce that Caixin is going to be providing us with a weekly news roundup of economic financial news out of China. It's going to be a regular feature of our podcast from now on, starting today, in fact. More importantly, we are going to have some of Caixin's excellent reporters and editors, perhaps even Wang Shuo, or dare I say it, Hu Shuli herself. So before we dive into the topics for today's show, let's hear the week's business and financial news, courtesy of Caixin.
This is a news update from Caixin. China's property tax may be delayed by a dispute between the central and local governments. The cities of Shanghai and Chongqing have announced their intention to extend the current property tax system to include residential transactions. But the central government plans to add a new property tax to the existing land levy. Caixin's reporter Wang Zhangyong spoke about the deeper reasons behind the dispute.
The central government's main reason for introducing a property tax is to give local governments a stable source of income, and controlling house prices is a side effect of that. But the local governments are worried that the tax will have a big negative impact on the property market.
There is also controversy over who will implement the property valuation assessments necessary to implement the property tax.
There is a dispute about who has the right to decide property values. The Ministry of Finance and the Taxation Department are both keen to implement property value assessment, but it has not been specified who has the right.
The news comes after China's largest real estate developer, Vanke, announced a 70% increase in sales revenue over 2010. China is to invest 700 billion yuan in railways over the coming year. Caixin's reporter Zhao Jianfei spoke about the expansion.
The Minister of Railways, Liu Zhijun, said that China will build nearly 8,000 kilometers of new railway lines in 2010, and 7,000 kilometers of the new lines will start operation by the end of this year.
The new projects include a high-speed rail link between Beijing and Shanghai, which was originally planned to open in 2012, but is now likely to open as early as June this year.
The line will shorten the trip between the two cities to 4 hours, and the line can carry 80 million people every year, twice the capacity of the current line.
The growth of China's manufacturing sector slowed in December, according to China's official Purchasing Managers Index. China's manufacturing PMI in December was down by more than 1% compared to the previous month. Caixin reporter Lu Hairong gave her assessment of the decline.
Chinese banks raised reserve requirement ratios in November and increased interest rates in December, and it's likely these changes had an effect on China's PMI.
The website of the People's Daily Newspaper, which is owned by the Chinese government, has announced plans to list publicly on the Shanghai Stock Exchange. Here's Caixin's English editor, Han Wei.
So this is the first time for a Chinese news website to list publicly. It's likely that there will be more state-run Chinese media firms to be listed in the future.
Finally, the value of the yuan rose to a new high on the last day of 2010. Over the course of the last year, the value of the yuan has increased by 3% compared to the dollar. This has been a Caixin News Update. I'm Tom Hancock. For more information and the latest news on Chinese economics, finance, and law, visit our English website at english.caing.com.
Okay, great. I'm really happy that we're going to be doing this from now on, and we look forward to it. We're also going to be adding in the future a sort of weekly news roundup of non-financial stuff that Jeremy and I will cobble together every week. Okay, so today for our New Year's show, we are going to put together a roundup of the year's events. We've had a lot of Chinese media that have done year-in-review lists, and what's striking, really, is just how completely different these lists are. We're going to offer our own take on some of these events. But first, we're going to talk a little bit about inflation, which reached a 28-month high in November of, 5.1% now.
Right.
Mm-hmm. What's driving these rising prices, and is this rate hike that we saw come from the People's Bank of China sufficient to lower this? Li Xin, you want to take a crack at that?
A lot of people say that the food price is behind the rising inflation. But if you want to go a little deeper than that, sometimes the Chinese officials will blame the QE2, that is the Federal Reserve, this new round of quantitative easing, and also the low interest rate in other countries for the hot money. But we know that at home we have more deeper reasons and more profound reasons behind the inflation. For instance, the oversupply of liquidity, which has been around for a few years, and also something we call the Lewis turning point that everybody's talking about that today in China. And yesterday I came across an article from Cai Fang, one of the very respected scholar from the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. He said the Lewis turning point is going to reach China. That means the working age population, labor population, will peak in the year 2015. That means China will soon have a shortage of labor, which actually is appearing in some of the coastal cities and the cities. And also that means laborers will be hard to find, the wages will be higher, and of course the cost of products will be higher, and there will be higher prices as well. And this will stay. This is not going to disappear in a few years. So that's how serious the inflation picture is going to be.
Right. I think that pretty much captures it. I mean, there's a little bit, you know, some people who are more bulls about China say that the weather is to blame for some of the food price increases in terms of, you know shortages of even vegetables, et cetera. I think the structural factors that Li Xin just pointed to are more serious long-term problems. And so some of this problem is here to stay. Whether inflation will continue to be, 5% or more, that's an open question. But it's something that we know that the Chinese government is worried about and will continue to be worried about.
So China is certainly not the first country to go gray before it gets rich, as they say.
One of the issues we discussed in the last year, I think.
That's right. One of the many issues. I mean, I think that's probably on a lot of people's lists are the strikes at the Honda factory and, of course, the suicides at the Foxconn factories, all of which were wage-related, but not necessarily labor shortage or age-related, were they?
No, not necessarily. I think there was a short-term issue with a labor shortage that related to the stimulus and, heavy investment in projects that led to, suddenly resurgence in demand for workers, and also, exports kind of recovered. But I think maybe over the next couple of years you might not see as much of an effect of that as you will after 2015, as Li Xin was talking about.
What about this hot money problem? I mean, they're saying that it's the quantitative easing that we've seen, as well as just this ridiculously low interest rates.
And speculation on a rising
yuan. The rising yuan, of course, is the hot money driver.
I've seen definitely conflicting sort of arguments about whether things like QE2 are kind of over-blamed for this kind of thing. Mm-hmm, I think a lot of it is more to do with what's going on in China driving that demand for money coming in.
So it's food prices, Li Xin, you're saying? A lot of this is really hitting
the food prices is really the leading indicator, and it's behind most of the inflation runs that China has seen the year 1988 and 2004 and 2007. Each time we have inflation, it starts with food.
Right.
But it doesn't mean food is the reason behind it. It's just the leading indicator. And
2007 was pork, right?
It was pork.
Right.
Yeah.
There is hot money coming in, but Li Xin was pointing out earlier, there's a lot of what you could call hot money, but not the same term, right here in China that's domestically produced.
Yeah.
Homegrown money, hot money. And that is the result of a year and a half of heavy, heavy lending by the state banks, and still actually strong in recent months, but just not quite as, you know, quite as aggressive. The growth in money supply was 30% in 2009. To put that in perspective, it's in low single digits for a country like the U.S. In a normal year.
Well, 2009 was not a normal year.
But no, in a normal year, it's low. You know, and of course, 2009 it was non-existent in the U.S. and that was a problem. China went completely the other way.
How dangerous? What's your sense of what the real dangers are here?
We see the government is taking measures to control the inflation, and it rose the interest rate twice last year, and also raised the capital requirement ratio for banks. And also, in addition to that, there will be a lot of administrative measures as well. But everything takes time, especially if we want to tackle what Gary has just described, the problem of supply of money. You have to raise either the interest rate further or let the yuan appreciate. And both will take time, and I think...
You know, we saw the yuan go up above 6.6 to the dollar this week for a while. I mean, I think it's back below 6.6 maybe mm-hmm. now. But it's definitely rising, and I think maybe that pace will pick up because of inflation this year.
And last time I saw the prediction from the forecast from a number of economists, they all expect double-digit inflation as the peak of the year 2011. And some even say, the Gao Xiang went from the Anxing Security, he even said China has already entered an age of double-digit inflation.
Right. Actually, one of the things that's interesting about this is even back in as far as the summer, before these inflation headline numbers were coming out, you were seeing talk about food prices having gone up as much as 15% for a lot of people in a year. Someone who writes a bit for the Forbes China Tracker blog and has his own fine blog, Patrick Chovanec, did a very nice post at around that time called the KFC Index. And right. He's someone who's a creature of habit and gets the same meal at KFC. And he compared his price like 1 year after, and it was, I think, 20 to 30% higher.
Although I'm not sure a steady diet of KFC does one much for one's sort of quantitative analytical ability.
I know, that's definitely questionable.
Certainly inflate your belly.
Right. And I reprised this recently as the inflation story was starting to hit. I definitely think people on the ground have been talking about it, food prices going up, for much longer than just a couple months.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. That's the case.
Well, one anecdote I would add to that is some media friends working for state owned media told me that they are not allowed to name it as inflation.
So what did they call it? What's the euphemism?
Food price rising. Instead of inflation, they can only phrase it as food price rising.
That's great.
And how's that? What is that in Chinese? It's not 通货膨胀.
It's 食品涨价.
Can they call it crazy bad?
Whatever.
Let's move on. Let's look at the year in view in news stories, and we'll start with the official, as we should. Xinhua put out a list of important news events in 2010 that Jeremy was kind enough to put together for us. What was on their list?
Well, number one, the Shanghai Expo was successfully hosted in Shanghai. Woo!
Is this a David Letterman top 10 list?
Number two, Taiwan and mainland China signed an economic cooperation accord.
That was definitely one of my most memorable moments of 2000.
Yeah, come on, Michael. Let's not poo-poo that. That was quite important.
Number three, China introduced long-term education boosting plan.
I'm sorry, that was the highlight I was looking for.
Yeah, that doesn't make my list.
Then there was China celebrating the 30th anniversary of the establishment of Shenzhen and Zhuhai special economic zones.
How did you celebrate, Kaiser?
Well, actually, I mean, I think the celebration of the third plenum of the Party Congress, that was a legitimate thing to celebrate in December.
Right, okay.
Coming after that, the Yushu and Zhoutu natural disasters were defeated.
Of course they were.
Right. Because they reversed the damage completely from the earthquake and the mudslide.
And then we had China's 12th five-year plan. Was discussed during the annual session of the National Congress. That was
discussion.
A big piece of news.
Yeah.
Then Guangzhou successfully hosted the Asian Paralympic Games, Para Games. Then we have China debuting the world's fastest computer, which certainly did make headlines outside of China.
Sure, right. Sure.
And then finally, and very importantly, the central government gave its 8-character guideline on economic development. Positive, stable, cautious, and flexible.
I really see I missed my opportunity as fake Xinhua reporter to do my own list for 2010.
I think you may have to be fired from your post as
been replaced by Real Xinhua.
Yeah. So maybe really we should move on from there to a real list.
So there were a couple of real lists. There were lists put together by netizens on the Tianya Forum. There was a list that was put together by Nanfang Zhoukan.
Nanfang Zhoukan.
Part of the same group. Yeah. And those two actually have quite a bit of overlap. And, of course, they are, as Kong Qingdong says, these guys, of course, are traitors to the nation and should all be shot because they talk about things like Meng Niu hiring a black PR company to spread slander about its competitor. Problematic vaccine killed and disabled hundreds of children in Shanxi province. The Zhouqu landslide, of course.
Which happened in August 8th.
That was on right. Jeremy, you're the man with the dates here. Articles that were written by Meng Jianwei, a PhD student whose father was beaten to death during forcible demolition, caused all sorts of discussion on the internet. We missed that one.
That wasn't really a huge news, not as big as some of the other things on Nando Zhoukhan's
list. Right. I saw that happened in October.
The father was killed in October.
Right. There was the Dalian oil pipe explosion, which caused a very, very substantial spill, which was, I suppose, for China's good, it was rather eclipsed by, of course, what was happening in the Gulf.
And that was in July, in Dalian, July the 16th.
Then the babies with boobs, baby formula supposedly causing premature sexual development, and, of course, the later discovery that this was sort of black PR tactics, that it was depositioning on the part of competitors to particular companies.
This is, in fact, the same story as the Meng Niu, isn't it?
Yeah, that is actually right.
Meng Niu
versus
Ely.
I'm not sure why it showed up twice. I mean, just because one of them only sort of talks about the babies with breasts. Shanghai residents spontaneously mourned the deceased in the residential fire. We talked about that, where some 10,000, I mean, it was an estimated 10,000 people poured out into the streets of Shanghai to...
A week after the fire, on November the 15th.
Right, to mourn the death of 58 people in that fire, which was very significant.
And the band.
Then there was the Tang Jun scandal, where the former president of Microsoft China, Tang Jun, was exposed for having a fake diploma, a diploma from just sort of a crappy diploma mill school on the west coast of the U.S.
And that happened in July.
Right, and then there were the Foxconn serial suicides.
Which started
in
earlier in the year,
May was when the story exploded, right?
Right, and by the time they hit seven or eight of them, it was a really, really big story. That overlaps pretty clearly with the Tianya list. We've also got the Shanghai fire, the Yushu earthquake, the Zhouqu landslides. They include on their list, of course, Google quitting China.
Strange that wasn't on the other list.
Right. It is very strange they didn't appear on any of these lists because, David Drummond...
It was an official story.
Right.
I mean, Xinhua certainly had its treatment of it.
But that happened, of course, on the letter... January.
January
12th, which, by the way, was the very same day that Baidu was taken down for a few hours by the Iranian cyber army.
Huh. Yes. A story that I guess we somehow
perhaps
missed.
But Google actually switched off their local server for their search engine on March the 23rd.
Right.
It took them a few months.
Right, but January 12th would have been the day that you would have wanted to have started buying even more Baidu stock.
Yeah, if I had that time machine. We had the whole jailing of Li Zhuang, who's a lawyer defending, supposedly, alleged mafia bosses in the clampdown led by Bo Xilai in Chongqing.
Which in some ways was more 2009 story.
Really, the crackdown was all happening in that was definitely more of a 2009 story.
But the continued rise of Bo Xilai was a 2010 story. He seems to have solidified his position.
We'll see what happens
about that,
2012. But... finally, there were these stabbing incidents that took place in primary schools, in kindergartens in April and May. And then some of the other ones that were repeats, of course, were the Li Gang Gate thing, the Shanxi vaccine scandal, and then the Foxconn suicides. So that covers most of the major things between these lists.
There's one big story missing, of course, from all of these lists.
Which is, of course, Liu Xiaobo.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Liu Xiaobo.
Maybe, for some people, the biggest story.
I'm sorry, who's that?
Right.
姓刘的那个三个字
敏感词
敏感词刘敏感you actually solicited on Twitter for some suggestions for what people thought were some of the bigger news stories that might not have made these lists. Jeremy, did you get anything back?
A few responses. I think the Twitter world is a little asleep still after the New Year today, but Mr. Bill Bishop, our old friend at NeoB, said the mainstream end of the China fantasy. In other words, referring to the fact that foreigners now realize that China is just out to screw us all, and we're dealing with it.
I think he just needs to get back to work.
Bill needs a job.
Bill, you should come back to the podcast to defend yourself.
And they know cats.
You're losing it, Bill. Yeah. You're losing it.
Google was his next thing. North Korea was his.
Well, I think all of this was part of his.
Yeah, Google and that are sort of.
Yeah, these are all sort
related.
Of pieces of evidence: of Google, North Korea, the South China Sea stuff, Diaoyu Dao stuff.
All coming together to show.
That's more of a thematic thing.
China is now not the nice, cuddly panda that we were hoping.
Right, the panda bears its teeth.
Right. So an interesting collection from him. Sue Lorza.
Has anyone actually used that? The panda bears its teeth.
I think probably at some point.
Okay, sure. Sui Luoza is actually Josh Rosenzweig.
Right, and he had...
With the Duihua Foundation in Hong Kong. He's a great guy. He's been on a show talking about capital punishment in the past.
And always worth following on Twitter.
Absolutely.
He had Zhao Zhuohai,
yeah.
And who was sentenced to murder.
Well, sentenced to death for...
death for murder for 11 years. Well, and then only declared innocent when his... the alleged victim turned up alive.
Right. Was he actually... Right.
Which is a slight technicality.
Slight technicality. But, of course, that's his big issue, of course. And he refers us to a piece where Charlie Custer from China Geeks wrote about that. Elissa Ray, I don't know her myself, but she put her finger on what I think is one of the most significant stories of 2010, which is the rise of Sino Weibo.
Which is the story of the second half of 2010, really.
So the company is actually just about 15 months old now, right?
It's pretty young, yeah.
Yeah, it's 15 months old. And what are we at now? 85 million users, I believe.
It really seemed to surge in the last 6 months.
It's an absolutely astonishing phenomenon. And I was actually giving a talk today to a group of students from Harvard Business School and talking about this and how what a headache it must be.
Well, I mean... This is a long-term thing that the government is obviously trying to be active on as well. We've already seen that they're using Weibo too. And it's all part of this sort of, does the internet make people more free or does it also help the people in power preserve power? And I think Weibo will also have cut both ways.
Absolutely. It always does, right?
Right. And as much as it gives people some accountability in some of these cases that we're talking about, that were stories of the year, where really some of the activism about them took place on Weibo. And the reason they even came to people's attention was on Weibo. But that serves a couple purposes for the government too. In some cases, a check on corruption that they could never have handled. And in another way, a much broader way, giving the citizens a sense of empowerment without giving them the vote.
So Li Xin, what's your take on Weibo? Has it done more to sort of empower the netizenry, or is it just a mere kind of... safety valve and functions as sort of a watchdog that helps the government to weed out malfeasance here and there? Is it both?
I think it's both. But from a journalist's perspective, especially for Chinese journalists, I think it's perfect source of leads that we can follow. So we all love it. But increasingly, government officials, especially propaganda officials, are encouraged to use that to spin public opinions. So it's left to be seen how savvy they will be.
Do you think that they're at all successful in spinning public opinion on that? I mean, my sense is that there's
Can't you envision a future, Kaiser, where there'll be lots of poisoned discourse, just as we have in American democracy?
Sure.
Basically, it won't just be that the government has voices. There's lots of factions within the general public.
Right.
And I think some of that will be directed at the government. But there will also be a lot of other sort of cross flows. And so I don't think it's going to be just a clear picture of, the government besieged.
Right. But, my clear sense is that the right, which is to say the more sort of freedom-minded liberal intelligentsia, their voice dominates on Weibo. Maybe I'm just following selectively, but it just
I think that's definitely what rises to the top right now, and that's definitely what the media is latching onto, which is it's a great moment for the Chinese media.
Very interesting, very interesting. I promised we'd have a little bit of a chat. Why don't we jump in right now, talk a little bit about this WikiLeaks cable, which is one of the ones that most recently came out. What was significant to you about this? Just to give you a little bit of a background on it, one of the WikiLeaks cable, I don't have it in front of me, so this is all going to be entirely from memory. Cites a source who is a childhood friend who grew up kind of in the same UR as Xi Jinping, whose father, like Xi Jinping's father, was sent down during the Cultural Revolution and rehabilitated. And they knew each other in early childhood and were reacquainted later in life, and he purports to have all sorts of assessments about his personality. He talks about the volatility of the marriage that he had to his first wife. He talks about him as an essentially kind of a boring guy who was extremely career minded and ambitious from day one, who, unlike so many of the other people who sort of turned to criticism of the party, rather embraced it and decided, I'm going to win in this system, and went on to very much do so.
Right. Well, the ambition part and the sort of deciding to hew to the party from an early age, I think even as his father was in jail, is that right? He joined the party.
While his father was still.
And it demonstrates, I mean, that kind of consistent with what you'd expect it would take for someone to rise to the top of the system. But there has been some questions, I mean, about whether this source really had this kind of close relationship with Xi Jinping, right?
Right. A lot of us who were China watchers immediately thought, well, there's enough information here to ascertain who this source is. I mean, they give quite a bit. He's a professor of political science at an American university.
Born in 1953.
Born in 53, same year as Xi Jinping, that he did his graduate studies at a Washington, D.C.-based university, which, we can only assume must have been Georgetown. I don't think anyone's outed him yet. I think there are a lot of people who essentially know who he is at this point. But more to the point, Xi Jinping, if he gets wind of this, and I'm sure by now he has, he now certainly knows who this is, who had, taken an appointment with an embassy official and sat down and spilled his guts.
Right.
The dangers of WikiLeaks. What do you make of this? I mean, do you think the redaction process was just woefully inadequate here?
Absolutely. I think that's an overall problem with WikiLeaks, and I don't even think it's just an issue of redactions. WikiLeaks sent out the raw cables to, a number of news sources. They're out there. There's more than just five people in the world who have seen the original cables. And the Chinese government and a number of other authoritarian governments, I'm sure, are going after trying to find the original unredacted documents. They're pouring through the redacted documents to see connections. You can figure out who sources are. And I think this is really going to end badly for a few people. And I think that's a great tragedy of this WikiLeaks scandal.
I'm so conflicted over WikiLeaks myself. I cannot decide whether it's a net good or net bad thing. I understand right. full well the need for governments to be able to conduct diplomacy with confidence that what they are saying is in confidence.
My personal instinct is that this is not the Pentagon Papers. This is not the secret history of a government lying to its people about a war. A lot of this stuff is just gossip for us. Voyeuristic, not really necessarily enhancing how countries will relate or how we'll understand world affairs. And yet the costs could be high. And I think long term, my instinct, I also have instincts for openness, of course, as a journalist, and transparency. But I don't know, something about this makes me very uneasy. And as much as I enjoyed going through the cables, I don't feel like reading them like that I had a right to see them.
Right. I felt kind of dirty. Assuming that what the source has said is true or has some enough semblance of truth, what is the has this changed your image of?
I should say I didn't feel dirty reading them. By the way, I just meant we didn't have a right to have access to them.
Right.
We have access to them, and we should go ahead and do that. We have the right now because it's they're out there.
Is your opinion of Xi Jinping changed because of what you've read in this? Is yours, Li Xin?
Before that, we have very little information about who he really is and about his personality. And this definitely is one of the rare chances that you can get a glimpse of. But we don't know
how accurate
that is. So there's a big question mark there.
I must say, I'd always thought of Xi Jinping as not being boring. He's characterized as being boring. Well, maybe it's just boring to women. But my strongest impression of him had been his remarks to the Chinese businessman in Mexico about Chirbal Meshugan, why, Grant, foreigners have eaten too much and have nothing to do, blaming China for a host of ills, which I always thought were quite funny and rather endeared him to me. But this cable makes it seem as though he's a very boring guy.
I have to say I liked, in terms of getting an insight into his character, this cable to me wasn't quite as revealing as the one about Hollywood movies, where he was having dinner with Ambassador Rant and they recount his movie tastes. That was interesting. He likes
World War II movies, Saving Private Ryan.
Right, he likes World War II movies where you know who the good guys and the bad guys are. Very interesting, comment. Because the good always wins in those movies. So there was sort of, it's almost a little bit of a propagandistic instinct as well. But he also, condemned recent Zhang Yimou work, which is...
Well, so do I.
Right, but considering that the reason that Zhang Yimou gets a lot of criticism is because his movies seem to have kind of gone more towards a little bit of a nationalist sort of tilt.
Speaking of movies, have any of you guys
seen... And yet, he thinks he's gone away from his art.
Have any of you guys seen Let the Bullets Fly yet?
Haven't seen it yet. Looking forward to seeing it.
Really?
It was the top trending topic on Weibo this morning.
We need to talk about this on a future podcast because it's deeply, deeply subversive. It's truly, it's kind of an astonishing thing that this was allowed to get out there. Because
right. I hear reports that the government was ordering fewer showings?
Supposedly. But, it's still definitely available. It's in my neighborhood theater and it's on like four screens there and you can see it pretty much, any time between 10 in the morning and midnight. The theater was packed. I saw it on a Wednesday night at around 10 p.m. and the theater was absolutely packed.
And I'm sure we can go to online video for a pirated version. Right?
Soon enough. Listen, Happy New Year, everybody. 2010 was an incredibly eventful and in many ways just profoundly depressing year. Here's to a better 2011. We really look forward to working with our friends from Caixin this year. And we hope you'll keep tuning in to the Seneca podcast. Thanks a lot. On behalf of Jeremy, Gotti, and Lee Sin, this is Kaiser Guo. Signing out. Good night.